Thank you.
Well, first of all, good evening, everybody. I'm Christine Chinkin, and I'm director of the Centre for Women, Peace and Security at the LSE. It's a centre that essentially works on gender-related conflict issues, women's human rights, women's empowerment, women's leadership. And first thing I want to do is welcome you all here tonight, that you've braved the weather, resisted Christmas parties, and have come to what I know is going to be a really, really good evening. First of all, again, I would especially like to welcome this great array of panelists. I wonder when there was last one, two, three, six women on a panel at the LSE. So welcome to all of you. We are delighted, we at the Centre for Women, Peace and Security, are delighted to be co-hosting this evening's event, which is a launch of a special issue of the Oxfam Important Journal on Gender and Development, relating essentially, as you can see, to working on gender equality in fragile contexts. We're co-hosting with Oxfam, not surprisingly, also with the OECD and the network UK organisation Gender Action on Peace and Security. Thank you, Hannah. usually known as GAPS, a much easier one to remember. I'm just going to literally welcome you and hand over to the panel. But just before I do, I would like to make one comment, which is that I think it's especially appropriate that we're having this evening at this particular date. We are towards the end of the global 16 days of action on tackling gender-based violence, violence against women. And inevitably, issues around gender equality in fragile contexts will touch on issues of violence. And so I think that to have this here to mark the 16 days of activism is especially important. So without any more ado, I'll hand over to Caroline, who is going to chair the evening and to explain the format and so on. Caroline is Caroline Sweetman. She's from Oxfam. She's the long-term editor, I believe. In fact, we were just reminiscing that we sort of knew you, what, some 15 years or so ago in the context of the journal. So long-term editor, I think you're to be congratulated on it being such a great journal. And also an expert, has affiliations with Lady Margaret Hall in Oxford, Oxford Brookes University, with respect to issues relating to gender equality and development. So, Caroline, welcome to the LSE. Thank you for coming. And come.
Thank you very much. Good evening. Thank you for the welcome, Christine. We're thrilled to be here for the launch of the special issue of Gender and Development on working on gender in fragile contexts. We would like also to thank all the participating institutions and individuals who are here to do this tonight with us. According to World Bank estimates of September 2016, 2 billion people live in countries where development outcomes are affected by fragility, conflict, and violence. By 2030, the share of the global poor living in fragile and conflict-affected situations is projected to reach 46%. In these places, justice, stability, and security balance on a knife edge. Fragility creates and drives acute poverty and want. It means no security, no peace, no access to justice. It is widely seen as creating global problems beyond the fragile contexts themselves, linked to globalised conflicts and terror. Aspects of fragility, for example, endemic violence, also affect communities who are facing inequalities, perhaps as migrant populations in the global north. So it's not just about the countries that are conventionally focused on in international development. The power dynamics which play out in fragile contexts where violence is widespread and armed conflict might be a memory from yesterday or a possibility tomorrow are gendered. Understanding how and what this means for women and girls, men and boys is essential to respond to the needs of those trapped in often desperate situations, but also to build a more peaceful tomorrow. So these are the concerns addressed in the new issue of Gender and Development, which was published in November by Oxfam with Taylor and Francis. So a few words just on the journal for those of you who might not know it. Gender and Development is unique in the world. It's the only journal to focus on gender and international development. It's also Oxfam's longest running gender project on gender equality project, seen as a contribution to understanding knowledge and thought leadership in the whole development and humanitarian field. Since 1993, it has been a forum for different voices of women's rights and development activists in the global South and North, working in different contexts and at different levels, theory to policy to practice and back again. For all the information on the journal and this particular new issue, you should have all got some flyers on the way in, which actually talk about the new issue, and you'll also see we have a website address on there at www.genderanddevelopment.org. So to turn to tonight, three of tonight's five speakers actually wrote articles in the issue, and tonight they'll share their insights and experiences with us. The two final speakers will consider what they've heard in light of their own experience as key activists working to ensure women's rights are upheld in fragile contexts. Everyone's got 10 minutes, except for Paul Hannah on the end, who's actually got five as the official discussant, but she actually pointed that out to me. I'd have let her have 10. So, and I will keep them as strictly as I can to time, so we've got plenty of time for questions from all of you at the end. The event will finish no later than 8. I'm being asked to say this. Afterwards, please could you join us for a reception, which I understand will be held in the reception area, and all of you are welcome to that. Please can I ask you to remember to silence your phones, but if you'd like to take to Twitter to talk about the event, then please do, and use the hashtag, #LSEGenderDev, and I think we're about to have a slide which will give you that hashtag. The event is being filmed, and again, this LSE says, technology permitting, the recording will be posted on LSE Women, Peace and Security website and also on the journal's website in the coming days and shared via social media. So, that's me done. What I'd like to do now is to hand over to the first speaker, who is Diana Kirster. Here. Diana advises the OECD DAC International Network on Conflict and Fragility on gender peace building and state building, and she's also conducting DFIL politics research on these issues at the University of Oxford. So your 10 minutes starts now, Diana. Welcome.
Better run to the podium with these time constrictions.
Okay.
So I better start, but thanks for the opportunity to be here with all of you. It's really great to be here with all of you today. And as Caroline mentioned, what I do is I work with the OECD, and in particular, one of its committees, the Development Assistance Committee, the DAC. And as many of you know, the DAC brings together many of the largest donors of development aid to basically discuss how they can improve the effectiveness and the impact of the development corporation. And in recent years, donors coming together there have increasingly discussed how they can improve the impact of their work on gender in fragile contexts, really recognizing, for many of the reasons that Caroline outlined, that there are particular challenges but also particular opportunities in that area. The OECD, by the way, understands fragile contexts, and I know there are many understandings, understands fragile contexts as countries, as regions, as environments that face particular risks, be it of violence, of conflict, of natural disaster, but don't seem to have the capacity to address or to mitigate those risks. So increasing discussions on how to improve donor work on gender and fragile contexts and the new development framework that we agreed last year, our governments agreed last year, Agenda 2030, added some urgency to those discussions. because it thankfully integrates very ambitious goals, as many of you will know, on gender equality and for the first time also on sustainable peace and effective institutions. So with that in mind, some of us working with the Secretariat for the DAC have been doing some research to try and help donors understand how they can do better in their work on gender and fragile contexts. And we did two pieces of research that we summarize in our article for gender and development. So what I'd like to do with my couple of minutes is just flag a couple of the key findings for you. And I think overall what we can say is that those two pieces of research together say that donors can do better not only by doing a bit more on gender and fragile contexts, but also doing things a bit differently. First, in terms of doing more, a first piece of research looked at how much development finance is going to gender equality in fragile contexts, using some of the data that the OECD collects on this. And I think my first slide shows our first, my first and only slide. If we can switch it, I don't know who has the, I have it. Okay, here we go. Great. So my first and only slide shows what we first saw, which was a really a positive first observation, which was that aid to gender equality really grew over the years and actually increased fourfold over the course of the MDGs. And our kind statistician actually sent me some updated data on this last year, which you see yesterday. Which you see on the slide, so that's even newer than what we feature in the article. So a positive trend at first sight, but of course when we started disaggregating, as often happens, and you look a little bit more closely, the picture became a bit more mixed. We saw massive variations from one country to the next in terms of donor commitment to gender equality between different sectors, and in particular the harder sectors like the peace and security sector, the economic and productive sectors being relatively neglected in terms of gender inequality. And we also saw that most of the aid that donors report as targeting gender equality doesn't actually primarily target gender inequality. Most of this represents projects and programs that integrate gender as a secondary objective, some gender-related activities in wider activities that actually have a different overall objective. So that means that donors can do more to address those gaps in sectors, in countries, and through more targeted initiatives. But overall, an encouraging trend. But of course, what we then also thought about is that, you know, this is a positive observation, but what does it actually mean for men and women living in those situations? Does this actually translate into effective programs that have a good chance of tackling gender inequalities and supporting sustainable peace and tackling fragility? So in a second piece of research that we're about to publish at the end of this year, and we also summarize in our article, we had a closer look at the quality of donor programming on these issues, and in particular, we looked at four of the countries that receive fragile contexts, that receive some of the highest amounts of gender equality-focused aid, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, Ethiopia, Nepal, and Bangladesh. And in each of those countries, we looked at a selection of donor programs targeting gender equality in a variety of sectors, and I think overall, we had a look at programs by 17 different DAC donors. And then we asked, do these programs reflect what we know seems to work in integrating gender into donor support in fragile contexts, and in particular, do they address the specific impacts and links between fragility and gender inequalities? And then secondly, we also thought about what are the factors within and outside of donor organizations that impact the quality of programming on gender in fragile contexts. So very briefly, I'll just summarize some of the findings. A first observation that we made, again, was a relatively positive one, which was that the donors that we looked at do recognize specific impacts of conflict and violence on women, and all of the programs that we looked at made some efforts to address those specific impacts of conflict and violence on women. So that's some good news. The quality of donor responses to these specific impacts varied a bit. We saw some really good examples, programs, for example, that really consulted in a meaningful way with women affected by conflict, that really tried to reach out to the most excluded groups. But we also saw some programs that were rather short-term, not really reflective of local needs and didn't seem to think very deeply about how they can lead to sustainable change. Secondly, though, although donors did look at specific impacts of conflict and violence on women, they didn't seem to think very deeply about the impacts of wider fragility issues on women, and on the gender equality issues that they're trying to work on and that they're trying to address. So So, for example, there didn't seem to reflect very much on the impacts of corruption on women and gender equality, identity politics, violent extremism, and so on. So, for example, in Nepal, we looked at some work to try and increase women's political participation, which was pretty good work, but didn't seem to think about how women's political participation is constrained in a wider political system that's shaped by patronage, didn't seem to think about how rising identity politics make it harder for women to mobilize around common gender equality concerns, because, of course, in that situation, it's quite hard for women to come together across those really hardened identity fault lines and mobilize for common gender equality concerns. So some understanding of the links between the impact of conflict and violence on women, less so of the impacts of wider fragility issues on women and gender inequalities. But thirdly, basically no one seemed to ask the reverse question. So how do gender relations, gender inequalities, women's participation shape conflict and violence and opportunities for sustainable peace? As many of you around the room will know, by now we have significant evidence that women's economic participation, their participation in constitution-making processes and peace negotiations, their peace-building activities at different levels of society can make a really valuable contribution to sustainable peace for everyone. We also have increasing evidence, and I've got 3 minutes. We also have increasing evidence that gender relations, and in particular, gender norms that associate masculinity with violence and dominance can contribute to conflict and violence. But in the programs that we looked at, that evidence wasn't reflected. Donors didn't seem to be asking those questions. So to the extent that they were working with women affected by conflict and fragility, they tended to see them as passive beneficiaries rather than active agents in building peace, rather than as part of the solution for a sustainable peace for the entire society. And they didn't seem to think very much about how gender relations and inequalities might fuel conflict and violence. An exception was a program that we looked at in the DRC that was trying to tackle street violence by working with young men on gender norms. Just briefly, a couple of other headline findings that we had. One of them was that overall, donors didn't seem to engage very meaningfully on the underlying gender norms that tend to drive gender inequalities, which raised some questions about the long-term impact of their activities. They didn't seem to engage with men, unfortunately still, very systematically on gender inequality. Very concerningly, there seemed to be a lack of accountability for doing no harm, so exposing women to more risk through women's empowerment activities or entrenching gender inequalities through gender-blind activities. And then finally, we saw that there's really room for progress also in donor coordination on gender, and that was particularly finding in Nepal. So overall, what that means is that we found not only that donors can do a bit more on gender and fragile contexts, they can also do some different things to do better. And I think a red thread that runs through many of our findings is that there still seems to be a relatively narrow and a relatively apolitical understanding of what it means to work effectively on gender and fragile contexts. Narrow in the sense that there's a focus on women, which is great, and their capacity, which is great, but there doesn't still seem to be enough attention to the underlying gender relations and how they link to conflict and fragility. Apolitical in the sense that there doesn't seem to be sufficient focus on gender power relations, including how those might lead to harm and how they're linked to the wider distribution of power in society. So we're thinking about some recommendations that we can now make for donors to address those gaps. Maybe we can talk more about them in the discussion. But one I wanted to flag, because I think many of you around the room might be able to help, is that we need more research on the links between wider fragility issues and gender inequalities and relations. So links between corruption and gender inequalities and women's participation, identity politics, violent extremism. All of that research would be extremely welcome and very helpful for the donors, including those coming together in the DAC. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Diana. So our next speaker is Corrie Sissons, who is a member of the Emergency Food Security and Vulnerable Livelihoods team in Oxfam's Global Humanitarian Team and a former Emergency Food Security and Vulnerable Livelihoods Coordinator for Iraq. Okay. So over to you, Corrie.
Thank you, Caroline. I'm going to try the clicker here. So yes, hi, thank you for having me here this evening. So I'm going to be speaking about some work that Oxfam did in Iraq as part of our response to the crisis there. So just to give you a little bit of context on Iraq, for those who might not have any. So Iraq as a country in the last two decades has gone through significant amounts of change. Variety of conflicts, counter-terrorism campaigns, economic sanctions, as well as decentralisation within the country, have really led to significant challenges within Iraq. Gosh, honestly, from the moderator, in terms of service delivery, but also have really affected the socio-economic fabric of the country. Iraq is a sort of classic low-middle-income country, and the economy in Iraq is primarily dependent on the oil sector, but is also heavily dominated by the state. And within Iraq, service provision is really wrought with issues around policy shortcomings and corruption. And actually, today's topic of talking about fragile states, I would argue that Iraq is one of the most fragile states globally in 2016. You've got divisions between Sunni and Shia, between Kurd and Arab, between majority groups, minority groups such as Yazidis and Turkmen, and also between Muslims and Christians. And looking at that context, there are also deep divisions between men and women. So within this context, we also have an ongoing humanitarian crisis. And anyone who reads the news will be very aware of this at the moment. And so approximately 3.1 million people are displaced within Iraq at the moment. So that's about 10% of the entire population. But about 8.6 million have been affected by the crisis. And Iraq is actually the only country globally that is hosting two interagency standing committee level three crises right now. So it has not only its own burden of IDPs and returnees and people hosting them, but there are also about 250,000 Syrian refugees in Iraq. So it's causing a huge strain on the country. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about this area on the map, I don't know if you can see in pink, which is Iraq's disputed internal boundaries. So in north, in the red there, we have Iraqi Kurdistan, which is a semi-autonomous region, and in the white in the south is federal Iraq, and between those two is an area which is called the Dibs, we refer to them as that, which is essentially disputed between the government in Baghdad and in Erbil. And these areas are geographically characterized by the fact that that's where a lot of the oil is in Iraq, hence being disputed. But there's also high amounts of social tension in these areas and historically low levels of service delivery. And as a result of the campaign by ISIS, Daesh, to take parts of Iraq, there has been a huge amount of infrastructure damage in these areas as well. So Oxfam sort of chose these areas to be working in. And both within the disputed internal boundaries, but also within Iraqi Kurdistan and federal Iraq, there are historical and quite traditional fixed norms about gender. So men and women have sort of quite set roles. So what I'm going to be talking about is two pieces of research that we did. One of them, which is called the CLARA, which is the Cohort Livelihoods and Risk Analysis Assessment Tool. And I don't have enough time to go into the methodology, but if you go on Oxfam's website, you can check it out. It's really interesting. But for me as a livelihoods practitioner, this was a great opportunity to interview different livelihoods groups. So we looked at farmers, we looked at shepherds, we talked with traders. And within those groups, we spoke to men, women, boys, and girls to try and understand how they made money before the crisis and before they were displaced and how they were making money now, and what risks they were being exposed to as a result of their fragility. And we had lots of really interesting findings, but the main thing that came through for me as a livelihoods person was this limit that we saw increasingly on women's mobility. So both men and women said that women were much more restricted as a result of the conflict. So men felt the need to protect their women and girls, but also that women felt unsafe going outside to access markets or to engage in livelihoods activities as a result of this sort of stranger danger that they didn't know who was in their community anymore. And also we saw that women, compared to men, had much fewer sources of income. So men had quite a diverse option of different places that they could gain money, but women very rarely had more than one, and that also increased their vulnerability to shocks and to displacement. So one of the key things for me that came out of this was that actually only 12% of women we interviewed said they earned money for themselves, which is really quite low. And linked with this idea about women not having much mobility is quite sort of worrying. The second piece of analysis that we did is a gender analysis. Now, Oxfam have this as sort of a minimum standard that we do in all of our country programmes, be it development or humanitarian, but we did one in Iraq, and some of the key findings that we came out with for our livelihoods work were quite similar to what we had in the Clara. So 25% of women said that they were comfortable accessing markets by themselves, but actually 75% said that they no longer could, that not having a man or a guardian accompany them was an issue. And women repeatedly said that they found it difficult to earn money in displacement to access livelihoods opportunities. And this resulted in sort of negative, harmful coping strategies. So many of the men and women that we spoke to both said that they were borrowing more money, they were getting into more debt. And we saw also increased rates of families marrying off their young girls at an early age to get some sort of money in the household, which was leading to increased reports of sexual and gender-based violence. We also had many women saying that they felt like prisoners in their own homes, which was quite worrying. And this was also a result of social networks and them being broken by displacement and women not being able to access information as a result of being displaced. There were also some quite worrying psychosocial effects of the conflict, and this was particularly on men who said that they felt quite depressed, that they weren't able to work and provide for their family, and many women were saying that their men, their husbands were hitting them, which was also quite staggering for us. So the main statistic that I got out of this was the fact that 92% of the women we spoke to just didn't participate in local decision-making at all. And they also drew a link between contributing money to the household and decision-making. So many said, my husband puts money into the household, therefore he can make the decisions. So we started to say to ourselves, if from these two pieces of research we see that women aren't contributing much money and aren't contributing to local decision-making, if gender inequality and vulnerability are linked, can gender equity and gender equality and resilience be linked? And we had a programme in Iraq, which was funded by the UNDP, the United Nations Development Programme, which had three broad objectives: to increase household purchasing power, income in the household, to promote social cohesion. So this was in the disputed internal boundaries where social cohesion levels were quite low, but also to help rebuild and restore community assets, as there had been a lot of infrastructure damage. So we started saying, what can we do about women's economic empowerment in this environment? And the three activities that we worked on, we did some cash for work, which is where we do some community infrastructure and give some cash to our beneficiaries. We did some small business recovery, giving grants to returnees to help them restart their businesses. And we did some mobile income generation for displaced people to gain some income in displacement. And we had many men at the local level who basically said, no, women can't take part in this. And we went back and we basically said we disagree. We think that women are really key to economic success in these areas, but also that women should be involved. They are some of the most vulnerable in the Iraq context. And eventually, after lots of conversation, we managed to get some traction, and we managed to include very vulnerable women in these programs. We included widows, women with disabilities, single-headed households, and also, quite critically, we managed to get men to agree and women to agree that they could do some elements of childcare within those activities that maybe I can talk about a bit more in the discussion. So just to go through very quickly some pictures of our wonderful beneficiaries in Iraq. So we have a lady here who took part in our small business recovery program in the top right-hand corner, and she received a grant to help her restore a mini-market that was completely destroyed by Daesh in 2015. We have some women who are taking part in our cash for work program, baking bread, and also an IDP woman here with a host community lady who took part in some mobile income generation, and Oxfam helped to set up with a business making clothes. So coming into land within my 10 minutes, the impact and learning that we found from this was number one, we really felt that conflict can create a space to challenge gender norms. We had some great findings of what women used their money to buy. One woman I spoke to bought a washing machine, which is great because she would have to spend a lot less time on sort of household chores. Another woman I spoke to used the money that she had earned through Oxfam's programme to divorce her husband through a lawyer, which was a bit of an interesting one, but that, you know, she'd been reporting domestic violence. We also found that men can accept women to work in this context, and they can accept care work as valuable. that cultural and contextual considerations were really important, that we needed to take the tribal considerations and also the opinions of men into consideration. And finally, that it is important for the success of this programme to link to markets in the long term, that we don't want to do something short term, but to link women to local markets for their economic empowerment programmes to be successful in the long term. And I'm going to stop now. Thank you.
Split second timing. Right, so the second of the case study articles that we're able to feature here tonight after Corrie's in Iraq is Bella's, which is focusing on Afghanistan. Bella Grau is a PhD candidate at the Goethe University Frankfurt, and she is conducting an ethnographic research project on women's movements in Afghanistan. So over to you, Bella.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much to the organizers of the event for inviting us and for making it happen. I'm not only a PhD researcher, but I've also worked in the development field. I've worked as an Afghanistan program manager of the women's rights organization Medica Mondiale in Germany. So in my presentation, I'm going to focus on two points. One is the complex power dynamics that women rights activists are navigating in Afghanistan. And the second one is the gap between NGO activists and the rest of the society. I will start with a very short introduction on the context and where Afghanistan stands in regards to gender equality today. So the Soviet intervention in 1979 marked the beginning of today 37 years of war between varying parties, from communist groups to different shades of resistant fighters, the Mujahideen to the Taliban. In 2001, following 9/11, a US-led intervention together with Mujahideen groups swept away the Taliban government, and the successive international military and civil engagement has since shaped Afghan government politics and development efforts to a large degree. In spite of a remarkable effort in the field of gender, Afghanistan is still ranked at 152 out of 155 on the UN's Gender Inequality Index. And although reliable statistics are missing, it's widely agreed that violence against women and girls is still at extreme levels across the country. This leads many people in the West to assume that Afghan people are not interested in women's rights for reasons of culture or religion, and that change is being imposed by international actors. However, a closer look reveals that in urban areas, where things always happen first, change has happened and continues to happen. But space for activists to build up on these achievements is shrinking due to mafia structures and increasing religious fundamentalism. And it has to be said that the international community has played a role in this development.
So how does it go on? No?
Ah, okay. An activist describes it like this: you should have freedom to speak a little bit. Even that is, for me, security. But in Afghanistan, there is no security for you. Not only that bombing and killing, you are not secure from nothing here, especially being a woman, from all sides. So I'm looking at different approaches of three organizations that you see the logos here. One is Medica Afghanistan. It was originally started by the German women's rights organization Medica Mondiale, and it was nationalized in 2010. And the other one is the NGO Afghan Women's Skills Development Center, AWSDC. It was founded by a group of Afghan women's activists in Pakistan in 1999. And the third organization is the Solidarity Party of Afghanistan, the SPA. It's a political party that was founded in 2004, and gender equality is one of its main goals. In a country like Afghanistan, that the government is so corrupt as like there is no government, these criminals can buy everybody. They can commit anything that they want. If you are not connected well with the social power, you will be alone. Nobody will support you, and you will be very fragile. Anybody who wants to trigger some kind of attacks or anything, it's very easy. And as I told you, when we are working as a women's rights activist, we have been labeled. After the victory over the Taliban, the international community supported the establishment of a constitution that guarantees gender equality, but at the same time it brought leaders to the diverse Mujahideen factions back to power. Many of those old turned new power holders pursue agendas regarding the rights of women that resemble the ideology of the Taliban. Under the premise of security and stability, international actors, together with the Afghan government, have supported a series of undemocratic and anti-human rights developments. Women's rights groups like MA and AWSDC strongly support the current legal framework that promotes a gender-equal society and are determined to safeguard it. In contrast, the SPA strongly criticizes the current government and its international allies as corrupt and undemocratic, and considers the strengthening of existing structures as useless. Their view is that legal reforms are lip service only, tools to keep women in check. Women's rights, many of today's governmental power holders are connected to Mujahideen commanders or even to Taliban leaders. Often they have not only committed atrocities during the civil war, but are also well connected, well known today for committing sexualized and other forms of violence, or for protecting perpetrators of such crimes. Women's rights organizations use different strategies to cope with this scenario of high risk in powerful networks, while MA pursues a strategy of staying away from the warlords as much as possible. AWSDC cooperates with them as a way to reach out to people and to be protected. According to AWSDC, many of their awareness-raising projects on women's rights would not have been possible without these relations, especially outside of Kabul. The changes happen at the local level. That's where the power lies. The grip that they have on communities is through religion. A warlord in a community, for example, he has so many gunmen, he has so much money that he has taken from other people, and to keep people under his control, he needs some religious supporters. So what he does, he goes and pays for the mullah to be on his side, or continues building mosques or buying Qurans. So they are part of the same team, and many times they are the same people as well. So one of them is needed for the other to survive. Especially for less educated Afghans in rural areas, mullahs are the most important authority to refer to. They are considered to be healers, judges, and teachers. Some have inherited their position and are neither educated in Islamic studies nor in other areas. Others are highly educated scholars. In recent years, the position of religious leaders has become contested. Urban and educated young people striving for a modernized Afghanistan are starting to turn away. Religious leaders, afraid of losing power and influence over people, try to prevent change from seeping into their communities. Working with and through religious leaders is a strategy that several NGOs are experimenting with. Okay. Mullahs have a crucial role in weddings, a key women's rights issue, since child marriage is still rampant in the country. In the Quran, the age of marriage is connected to the maturity of the girl, and a popular interpretation is that girls are ready for marriage once they have had their first period. MA has developed workshops for mullahs on this topic, but staff describe these trainings as a very tough job. Insults such as "women are low in capacity and do not deserve to train men," or "looking at you women training us here is equal to inviting us for making sex," are frequent. Many mullahs do not accept women teaching them something related to Islam, and in particular NGO women. The training team, consisting of a medical doctor, a psychologist, and a lawyer who has studied at the Sharia faculty, illustrate the different health, psychological, and legal consequences of early marriage and its devastating effects on women, their children, and the whole family. In the end, most of the mullahs accept the explanations made. However, it remains unclear to what extent they change their messages once they are back in their communities. Okay. The SPA strongly believes in secularism and is strictly against the strategy of working with those it calls commercial mullahs, those being more interested in money than in religion. The rationale is that this will contribute to their increased power and status, while it will not change their attitude, and they might even use the opportunity to spread their misogynistic interpretation of Islam. At least in Afghanistan, if you want to change the situation of women, you need some very, very basic and very, very revolutionary changes. If you can only teach a woman, it's not enough. If you don't change and make a revolution in their mind. Now we have a lot of women who are educated, but still they are misogynist. Still they don't think, believe on their ability. Several activists I encountered perceive a gap between NGOs and the society. What seems to be missing is a broader women's movement rooted in the society and enabling women to jointly advocate for change on local levels. This would require a debate on gender norms among women as a first step, the building of a politicized sisterhood, as bell hooks calls it. In the Afghan context, it's a rare opportunity for women to come together outside their family to express themselves. Even the minority of women who attend secondary schools and universities do not usually have opportunities to engage in critical thinking about gender relations. MA has started this work and has developed peer support groups. These groups soon turn out to be a place for chat, but also for sharing among women who had not known each other before. They talk about their daily challenges, including domestic violence, and build relationships with each other, understanding that their problems are not only personal, but also political. The SPA also works on raising awareness on gender relations while showing them possibilities of change, expecting both women and men to push existing boundaries. They encourage people to start with smaller, bigger transformations in their daily lives, thus triggering change in their communities. If you start, another will start. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bella. Right, now, we've heard three very different levels of analyses from the journal, the OECD DAC's conclusions about how aid is spent and the impact on gender equality and women's rights, and two cases. May I introduce Renatu Sau, who is going to talk about her own work, which is not in the journal. Heaven knows I wish that it was, and if we had been able to contact each other at the commissioning time, she would have been in there, but we found her in time for the event. She's executive director of Make Every Woman Count, which is an African woman-led organization which serves as a mobilizing networking, information, advocacy, and training platform for African women by building their leadership capacities to influence policy and decision-making. Rai has over 10 years of experience working in the field of development, women and youth with organizations including the International Organization for Migration, the World Health Organization and UNICEF. So welcome, Rai.
Thank you. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you and Caroline, sorry. It's a pleasure to be here today and thanks for coming in this cold. And I'm going to a bit talk about meta-analysis. I don't really have a slide because I have to build on what has been said so far, but also to really convey the voices of women on the ground. And I'm going to talk a bit about how the movement of women's rights has evolved on the continent, what are the challenges they're facing, but also what are the initiatives and also the work they have been able to do so far. And to illustrate, I'm going to talk about about a trip we did earlier this year in Guinea, in post-Ebola Guinea and Sierra Leone. So the trip was to go and meet with women's group organizations, with women MPs, but also government officials to find out where are the problems, why we're still having so many obstacles in terms of gender equality. It was about the Maputo Protocol, which is an instrument of the African Union, which is about women's rights on the continent. And some countries have ratified, and the instrument is such a wonderful document because it really reflects the reality of African women. And it has been really, thanks to advocacy women's group on the ground, it has been so far 37 countries have ratified the protocol, but also it has been really been a lot pushing to implement the protocol and also to ratify at the AU member level as well. So, So we, the question was about, you know, what are the problems to this woman? And we met a lot of different type of women, which was amazing. But one group stood to me was this woman called the Market Woman in Sierra Leone. Why they stood that is because they are a network of women who work at the market. So what they do, they, like, you know, all this small trade, they sell, and they are the ones who hold the family back home. But they are scattered all over Sierra Leone, and they have a president. And they, we didn't think we'd be able to meet all of them, but they all, most of them came, had 100 people. We didn't have a space in the room to talk with them. And we were asking them, so could you tell us what do you do, who you are, and what are your daily struggles? And how can we help if there is help needed? So a lot of them stood up and told the problem they have, how some of them are dying outside because they don't have a space. They have to sell their goods outside on the rain, and sometimes, you know, they get kicked by people here in the zoo, and they are the one holding the family. So I asked them, so if someone comes and has got money, where do you want to help? And I know many people would think they would say money, but no, what they told me is education. They told me a lot of people come to do education, but because we feel like it's so sexy to say education for young girls, but people forget us. Because of the lack of education, we're not able to grow our business. We're not able to go ask for funding. We're not able to get loan, and we're not able to grow our businesses as most men do. So, and that's something shocked me because they told me they had already people coming to ask them, oh, can we have your daughter? Do you have a daughter to teach them? Because that's something as a, you know, us in the Western world, it's really sexy to us to, you know, girls' education. But what about, you know, women education? Who could really actually push the agenda forward to make sure the girls go to school, but also to make sure that, you know, the family is get together. So that really, I came back really, it's something I wasn't expecting. It really had a toll on me. So where is the problem? So why these women don't have the funding to do the work, but also where is the funding for women on the continent? And we met someone who working on FGM who told us, you know, we risk our life to do this work on a daily basis. We get the families who tell us, you know, why are you doing this kind of work, because this is our culture. So they go beyond all that, but at the end of the day, they don't get any funding. So they're asking us, where is the funding? Where would we, why are we not, the help, the work we're doing is not being, the support is not coming. But when you look at the funding the government, the UK government has put forward for FGM, it's quite 32 or 30 million, but it hasn't gone to women on the ground. So the question is, what is the problem? Why there is that gap between what is happening on the ground and what is happening us in terms of funding here to access those women doing the work on the ground? And it's a tough question. I myself don't have the answer to it, but when last week we had a big meeting, women's group coalition in at the AU summit in Arusha. And women's group, I told me, when I told them I'm coming to speak here, they told me, well, we want you to tell the people. So this is a message I'm conveying. We're doing fantastic work here, and we have been for the last decade pushing for laws on the ground. We have been advocating for women's rights, for women political participation, for, you know, women health and all that. But what we find ourselves into is the lack of funding to do, the lack of resources. And when you think about the lack of resources, it's not just about, you know, coming one off or coming doing training for us. We want something to sustain our work, something to help us to, you know, be able to make a change, tangible change that we're already doing. But because it's that on and off, it really doesn't have a tangible result on the ground. I'm just going to tell you a bit about some of those coalitions that are doing fantastic work on the ground. For instance, you have got the Solidarity for Women's Rights. This is a coalition that was created in 2003, and it was as a result of the adoption of the Maputo Protocol. And because of the advocacy, wonderful advocacy work, it's a coalition of 50 organizations all over Africa. So far, they have been able to really make sure that the protocol has been ratified for 37 countries. Not only that, but to make sure that countries have not signed or ratified or implement, you know, really do advocacy around the underground. And but themselves they're facing a lot of problems when it comes to, you know, country who at the EU at the moment, the space of NGOs is shrinking a lot. So you have got one side, these women could find themselves where they have to fight their country, but also the whole mechanism behind the shrinking of the space for NGO, but also the other side, the lack of funding that is not coming to them. So it's this, you know, I don't know how what is the word, but they find themselves in this limbo where it's hard for them to, you know, move forward in terms of saying tangible results for women's rights, but also how can they fight their government to have a result from implementing their agenda. So it's when you talk about a fragile state, most of us think about when there's a war or conflict. But fragile state is not only war and conflict, it's when there is an instability, when people can't claim their rights, when there's poverty, when people can't put food on the table. Because if someone can't put food on the table for their family, how can you want them to go ask for their right at their government? So we have to think in this dilemma and find out how can we work toward making sure that fragile state doesn't mean only when there's a conflict, but also how can we make sure funders and countries who are helping, there are a lot of countries supporting, don't you see the end of the conflict and we're gone, it's finished, our job is finished, but it's not, there's a lot more that need to be done on the ground. Women need to be, when the decisions are made, which is really important, it's overlooked, you know, but it's really important for women. If we want to have a laws passed, law on violence against women, law on health, child, marriage, all that, women have to be there to be able to make their voices heard. And but if they're not at the table, how do you expect for these women to, you know, advocate for it? But also access to information for these women is really lacking. If there is no access to information, they will not be able to go to claim those rights. So because there is this this kind of gap between funders on one hand and a women's group in another hand, is that how can we, people in this room, can we work to, but also, you know, this is a question to everyone, the panelists, but also people that, it's the question we need to think about what is working and what has not worked, what has worked so far, and also what is needed to help women to empower. So those are the questions I want us to discuss when we'll be opening the ground and see together if we could find solutions. So thank you.
Thank you, Rai. So it's now over to Hannah, who is director of GAPS, the UK Gender Action on Peace and Security Network, and we entrusted Hannah with the difficult task of being discussant for those papers, but also I hope to frame it within her own advocacy-led perspective on the issue of conflict and of fragile states and context.
Thank you, Caroline, and again, thank you all for coming. I think what's very clear from what people have already said is that conflict and fragility have a huge impact on women and girls, but also that impact is very distinct and is very much based on gender dynamics. What I hope to do now is outline sort of bring it back to what Diana was talking about the role of the international community and donors and the important role that governments and donors can have in that. But what I think is particularly clear of what has been spoken about so far is that women and girls experience conflict very differently depending on the context and a number of other factors. As international organisations and NGOs, we often try to make connections across conflicts. But it's very important to remember that different conflicts and different experiences affect women and girls differently. So an Afghan woman, where it's estimated that 87% of women experience intimate partner or domestic violence, is likely to experience conflict very differently to a girl in South Sudan, where 1 in 5 women dies in childbirth. She is very likely to experience conflict differently to a Syrian woman, where 40% of women of Syrian-headed household, of Syrian households within Jordan are headed by a female, and that has increased phenomenally up from 15% just 2 years ago. And that Syrian woman will have experienced conflict very differently to an older woman in Northern Ireland, where the impact of conflict is still very much felt, and where women are not represented on local committees, or are represented but to a very small degree on local committees that are tasked with community cohesion and development. But what I think is also very evident from what people have said so far is that it's very clear that women and girls' participation is absolutely essential to identify their needs, to identify their community's needs, but also to identify solutions and programming solutions. I think what is also very clear, particularly from what Bell and Rai have spoken about, is the important role that civil society play and women's rights organisations play in delivering services, in advocating for better provisions, but also ensuring that women and girls' voices are heard, and the importance of that feeding into what donors do. So in order to do this, consultation is absolutely essential, both to understand, to understand what drives conflict, how conflict dynamics change over time, and I think the examples of Iraq are really interesting there, that in a country that has experienced different conflicts over the last decades, how important it is to look at how the dynamics of conflict have changed, but also the gendered elements of that and the different conflict cycles. So Diana spoke earlier of the impact of masculinities in fueling conflicts, and that of course also changes across the conflict cycle. So it's really important that we speak to women and to men, women and men of different ages, different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different races, to support the identification of what their needs could be. But it's also really important that that is funded. And I truly believe that and that important consultation that can happen with organisations and individuals in conflict and fragile states is the only way that we can truly make progress to a more inclusive and peaceful world. The international community have made a raft of commitments on the Women, Peace and Security agenda. They're founded in UN Security Council Resolution 1325, but also in the Beijing Platform for Action, in CEDAW. Rai spoke about the Maputo Protocol and other continent-specific instruments. More recently, that movement has been changed slightly to a much more instrumental view of women and girls that essentially says that women and girls are more peaceful, therefore peace is more likely if they are included, or at least de-radicalisation is more likely. So that's the way that the rhetoric goes. However, this work has been very much founded upon the women's movement, where women essentially said, enough is enough, we have the right to be included. We have the right to ensure that gendered dynamics of conflict are assessed, and that must be recognised through peace processes, in constitutions, in programmes in refugee camps, and in disarmament programmes, as just some examples. The core international community commitments surround four overarching principles around participation, protection, prevention, both of violence against women, but also of conflict more broadly, and also responses in humanitarian settings. To meet these, countries should or in some cases are not, be developing national action plans on women, peace and security. The UK is currently on its third national action plan and developing its fourth. South Sudan is the latest to join this group of 40-plus countries. These national action plans should very much be driving how governments and the international community approaches gender in conflict, women and girls' rights, but also conflict more broadly, because what I think is very, very key is that without that gendered analysis, we won't be able to end conflict. And governments should be meeting those commitments. As I said, there's a raft of commitments having been made, and we should all be pushing them to do so. So there are a number of things that I think some have come out already and others that governments and international institutions must do. And that's fund this work. It's absolutely essential that they recognise and fund the, the import and recognise and fund work on women, peace and security. Also, that they acknowledge local voices and that those voices are not just of men and boys, but those voices are also of women and girls. Understand that conflict impacts different sections of society differently and design programmes to meet those different needs. Properly and systematically fund civil society and women's rights organisations, and not to keep hosting peace and security discussions with men because men hold guns and territory. As we heard from colleagues tonight, women and girls have extremely important voices and experiences, and they must be recognised.
Thank you very much, Hannah. One thing, actually, that I note having heard everybody speak is just reminding me in a sort of ghastly flashback about how very difficult it was to edit the issue of the journal because of the incredible complexity and the fact that it is such a very wide-ranging concept that we're dealing with here. People have talked about fragile contexts. They have sometimes referred to fragile states. That's true in the literature too. Sometimes we've talked about fragility and then we've talked about conflict. There is no time really to get into the complexity of the different understandings and definitions, but I would encourage everybody who's interested in the topic to go straight to the introduction in the journal, where my co-editor who's in the audience here tonight, who's Oxfam's senior advisor on fragile states and governance, Joe Rowlands, and I did our best to provide an account of how the field has evolved in terms of all of those different understandings and what we're dealing with. It is difficult, isn't it? It's very difficult. We've heard some practice, some policy, and some theory tonight. We've heard from different contexts. I'm sure that I would like to throw the questions over to you. So we have 23 minutes by my iPhone, and to fill with questions from the floor. If we could take questions perhaps in groups of three. There are some stewards coming down here now. Please could you signal, and somebody will come to you, and then if you could introduce yourself and your affiliation, that would be fantastic. Right, okay, so I can see somebody over there. You're on first.
Thought I'd be competing. That's why I was like, me. All right. Okay, so my name is Daniela Martinez. I am a student of development management at LSE. It's a master's program. And in my program specifically, I'm not taking any courses related to gender, but I did work back home with different development projects that had to do with incorporating and mainstreaming gender into development projects. So this is a very interesting topic for me. So I'm going to try to be brief with my question. So often in development, gender is automatically associated with women, women's empowerment, women's rights, which, you know, is obvious, and we need to be having these discussions. Obviously, as a woman, I definitely don't agree. However, what I've seen, at least in my experience, is that locally this results in a lot of resistance, particularly from men, who we cannot deny are usually the ones in positions of power. So my question would be it's twofold, actually. So to what extent do you think that this actually can hinder the work that we do to advance women and women's rights and women's development? So this sort of discourse on gender automatically being associated with women and men being, you know, sort of like, oh, here come, you know, the gender to tell us that women need to become men and, you know, that women need to take over, etc. Because locally that is what happens. And what do you think we can do about it? How do you think we can address that so that the work that we do is actually bringing men to the table as well. I think both two of you, if I'm not mistaken, Corey and Hannah, did mention the importance of also bringing men to the table. But what do you think we can do in practice to achieve that? Thank you.
Thank you. Another question? Right.
Thank you. So my question is for Diana. So did the wasted research that you mentioned take into account the nature and the focus of the intervention that we're trying to address, the gender-based violence? Because I remember you mentioned Bangladesh, and I'm from Bangladesh, a country where 87% women experience intimate gender violence. And I feel like it's the new kind of violence that are on rise, more particularly the one that are using technology to abuse women and sexually harass women. My experience of working with a nonprofit for about 4.5 years tell me that it's time we prioritize the aid allocation, like where should it go if we are trying to address gender-based violence, and is this research recommending any such thing or not? Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. There's somebody just up there, lovely.
Thank you very much. My name is Zainab Al-Sawi, I'm from Sudan. My question goes to Diana, the first speaker. Regarding the research, which I found very much interesting. You mentioned that how the donors improve their support to gender equality in fragile countries, and that the aid to gender equality has increased significantly. If you can just tell us more about how you measure that. When you talk about gender equality, you talk about so many social elements. Did you use like the same sort of methods or indicators in all countries, or you consider the social changes between countries? And when you talk about gender equality or women empowerment, there is a lot of like difference between quantitative and qualitative methodology, which is, I found the quantitative methodology are very much difficult to measure. So just tell us more about the methodology you use on the research. Thank you very much.
That's great, thank you. Who would like to go with the first question about the politics of working on gender, male resistance, and women's rights? And I think there's quite a lot of questions inside there. There's something on terminology and then something on male resistance, isn't there? So
I can talk about that. Yeah. Okay. So thank you. Yes, it's a really great question. And I mean, I didn't have much time to go into it into my presentation. But for us, I really don't think that our livelihoods work in Iraq would have been as successful had we not have consulted the men in the villages that we worked in. I think something that is quite important is to look at that and make sure that men are involved in the decision-making process around it. Often, in humanitarian contexts, agencies will target people based on vulnerability, and often women are amongst the most vulnerable. So for this, for the example I talked about, we'd targeted women who, based on vulnerability criteria, you know, were either widows or single-headed households. So it was fairly straightforward to demonstrate to the men why we'd selected the women to take part in it. And a lot of it was a little bit, what we say in the UK, you know, proof is in the pudding. Like, if we were able to show men at the end that actually women could meaningfully contribute, and, you know, we did one of our projects, the cash to work element was painting, and the men said, women can't paint. And we said, well, we disagree. So we sort of, we taught them how to paint. And then actually the men said, oh, the painting's quite good. And so a lot of it was just sort of, you know, in these communities, maybe they hadn't experienced that sort of thing and it's new. And I think agencies really need to be willing to accept a little bit of pushback to begin with and to keep on pushing. I think incentivizing, particularly one thing which we found with this research was how we target married women in these contexts, because often widows and female-headed households are selected, and because they are vulnerable, rightly so. But to look at more systemic change, it's quite important to find married women, and we were looking at ways, and this project has been expanded and is including married women, but to incentivize for husbands what the involving women that they're married to might be. And I do think that the livelihoods work, when there is sort of an economic advantage, is quite a good incentive. You know, if there's a way that we can make it advantageous to begin with, that they might be getting more money and if women are involved, and then they might see the added advantages of having a wife that earns money. And, you know, some of the men in the communities are very proud that their wife is kind of bringing in money. So, yeah, I think from the Iraq experience, that's sort of what we've done. But I think there is definitely a lot more. And I'm quite interested to what you're going to talk about with Afghanistan, because we haven't specifically done trainings for men. But I think that is a key element of it as well, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that there is resistance is to be expected if you want to have a change. So it's not a surprise. In the case of Afghanistan, I've also seen a lot of resistance. I mean, you heard about it from men, also talking about all of this women's rights stuff. And also it's true that there is also gender-based violence against boys, for example. There's a systematic sexual exploitation of boys, which is not tackled at all. I think it's even more of a taboo. So it's definitely important to also integrate other forms of gender-based violence, for example, in the laws. So I think both approaches are important, to have women-centered approaches and at the same time some kind of gender mainstreaming approach at the same time. Yeah.
That's great. Rai or Hannah, would you like to add to that?
Well, I think it's really it has been the having women men in working together has been really left out for the last few, but recently has been a lot of movement to bring more men to work together. So there are a lot of initiatives. Before, you would never hear a men's group working on gender equality, but now there are quite a lot of initiatives. There are quite a few. There's a really big one in South Africa, I can't remember the name now, has been working a lot to help not only men to really not to feel that as a man I shouldn't cry or people shouldn't see me crying in public and all that. So there has been a lot of work, but I think there's a lot to be done as well, because when it comes to involving men in this work, it starts at home. So how are we treating men and women together? How are we treating our kids? And this is something we quite often underestimate. We say, no, society can do it. It has to start at home. Make sure that the man, you reassure him, he could cry, he could act as it's normal for them to show their feelings. But if we don't show those kind of people go out there as a man, you should say, well, I can't cry, or I have to do this and that. So it's really important to try to put both sex at the same level, starting at home. Education on gender equality needs to start at home. And this is only men and women. It has to be not only focused on women, but it has to be, the boy who, tomorrow is going to be the man who may be going to be victim of sexual abuse as well. I remember in Congo, for instance, there have been a lot cases of men who were raped as well, but they never come forward, and you never hear about it because there's this stigma that as a man, you should keep it to yourself. So I think we really need to, not only engage, but also support men to come, speak, but also to put that manhood beside that, you shouldn't cry. So I think it's a work in progress. There's a lot to be done, but I think there's already a lot, initiative and activities happening on the ground that is really, really reassuring that we're going to have some positive outcome.
I think, essentially we live in a world where the patriarchy reigns, and we haven't got this far by only allowing men to have space to talk about women's rights. So whilst I think it's hugely important that we engage men, and there has been a great increase in work on engaging men and boys within gender and women's rights programming, we also have to acknowledge that we live in a very patriarchal world, and you need to push the boundaries of that patriarchal world to enable progress. So I think within that there are two really important things. One is that we take the lead, particularly from local civil society organisations and women's rights organisations, about where they feel the boundaries can be pushed, and the work that they have done that has been successful and unsuccessful. And I think the other thing is gender analysis. And I think the presentation of Oxfam's work really showed the importance of that. and the importance of sort of pushing those boundaries on gender norms, on women and girls' rights, but also engaging men within that discussion.
Thank you very much. Right, well, there were two for you, Diana.
Yes.
Do you want to go with the first one on intimate partner violence?
Yes, please. Is this on? Yeah. Thanks so much for the questions. On sexual and gender-based violence, yes, we did look on some programs, at some programs tackling sexual and gender-based violence. And actually, encouragingly, we found that at least the ones that we looked at were relatively strong compared to other work in other sectors. So really, sexual and gender-based violence was the area of work where we found that programs were most reflective of what we know works, what we have evidence of working in supporting gender equality in fragile contexts. Women's economic empowerment, by contrast, was an area where practice was rather weak. So thanks for that question. And on the methodology for the quantitative work that we did, the OECD, the DAC, uses something called the gender equality marker. And basically what happens is when donors report how much they're spending in different countries, they also use a tool that is asking them to report whether their programs target gender equality as a primary objective, as a secondary objective, or they don't target it at all. And that comes with some guidance on what that means. And if you'd be interested to find out a little bit more, I can put you in touch with my colleague who works on that in particular. Just really briefly on the question on women and gender and engaging men, I think that's really important for the effectiveness of our work, also for doing no harm. I just wanted to add that I think also within our own organizations, within donor organizations, there is still some work to be done. In communicating that working on gender is an approach that can make all of our work more effective and more meaningful and goes beyond only working on women. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to just add to that and abuse my position as chair and to say that one of the things that we tried to do in the journal issue is to talk about the fact that patriarchy, that is male domination of women, actually intersects with other aspects of identity, and you will find that it is the poorest and most disadvantaged men in all of our societies who end up as foot soldiers in these wars. And we have an excellent article in the journal from somebody talking about the reintegration of former combatants in Colombia. That's Isabella Fliss's article. And she emphasizes the fact that processes which disarm and reintegrate ex-combatants fail women and girls as well as the men themselves if they don't address the fact that those violent masculinities which are started in childhood in relation to bringing boys up to think of themselves as needing to protect, are distorted. And actually women and girls can protect as well. Men and boys can be vulnerable, just like women and girls can be. But these very gendered, stratified ideas that assign one set of characteristics to one sex result in societies where everybody loses out. They're violent societies and societies of domination. So we were trying to show that gender stereotypes actually drive conflict and fragility in some of the content in the issue. So I'd invite people to read those aspects of the journal too. I better shut up. I'll get some more questions. So I've got one question from over there, and I've got another there and one over here. From the person in the pattern jumper there. So perhaps we better take those three, please. The steward, if you could go just up there. It's the pale blue jumper. Sorry, I'm describing you by clothes.
Well, just take that question there.
Right.
She has the mic, so it's fine.
Okay, great. Lovely.
My name is Kate McConnell. I'm originally from... Oh, sorry. I've never used this. This is the second time. My name is Kate McConnell, and I'm originally from Ethiopia. At the moment, I'm a member of WILF, which is Women's International Organization for Peace and Freedom, and a member of Voice of Africa for Women. At the moment, we are working with WILF and Voice of Africa on three different countries. One is Ethiopia, and the second one is Sudan and Somali. I'm supposed to be working within these three organizations. And one of the things we've come across, and we are very much struggling at the moment, is with the Sudanese Women Peace and Freedom. The lady who is in charge of this organization is called Mama Khadija, and she's been working on this issue, Sudanese Women for Peace and Freedom, for many, many years, and she's struggling. I don't think she's ever come across any kind of donation from any countries or NGOs. The same also with the Somaliland women and orphan organization, which is run by Mrs. Shamis Farah. And she is also a sole funder of this, her project. And she, both of them, they are very much struggling. And WILF is trying to work on their behalf, you know, which is very, very difficult to raise fund. And I also heard from the first speaker that Ethiopia was one of the countries which has got, money. And in Ethiopia, I have inherited an orphan and some women who've lost their livelihood and their parents, the orphans, their parents through genocide and ethnic cleansing. And in Ethiopia also, we've been doing a small amount of research yet where women are mutilated. We've collected some pictures, you know, where these activities has been done. And the government is actually the one who is inflicting directly to the women and children. And it has been highlighted through WILF, you know, to the British government. And I would like to ask how they can access this grant directly to these organizations, because the governments are not to be trusted. You know, they are the one who are inflicting the problem. And at the moment, there is a popular movement to get rid of the Ethiopian government and, you know, some of the countries who've been supporting them. They're trying to support the opposition, and we are actually in the process of demanding for a transitional government to take place in Ethiopia.
I'm sorry, could I respectfully ask you to just try to keep it short?
Yes,
because we've got another three.
I mean, it is a very serious issue. I mean, I haven't got any word to express how urgent and how difficult it is. You know, waters have been contaminated. The women and the children are the ones who are being victimized. We have no access. There is no internet access or any kind of access. And, you know, with due respect, you know, to your organizations or funders, they are funding actually the wrong people who are committing these crimes. Mm-hmm. So I would like to know what is the easiest and the strongest support that people, the civil society and the NGOs can get money to address these issues.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Right. Could we take the question from the person in the blue there, please?
Yeah, mine's less of a question as it is maybe a public announcement. I think timing's everything, but I'm Jack Balland. I'm a freelance consultant in ID, and I'm the former director of Destin here at LSE. We have a very good network. I appreciate all your time this evening, by the way. We have a good network, and there was actually just a call for a proposal to come out for training materials in South Sudan and Juba that promotes women's role in peacekeeping and gender-based violence prevention. They're looking for somebody to develop training materials for that, starting immediately. So if there's anybody that's interested in that, I'd be happy to share the TORs. perhaps there's a ton of expertise up there on the stage already. You guys might already have some types of resources that can help.
Sorry, could we take this offline and we'll talk to you after? We're interested, but we need to stick with some questions at the moment. This gentleman here, please, just behind you with his hands up there.
Thanks. My name is Pete Sims. I'm from Children in Crisis. We're an NGO working in fragile states for young people and education and child protection. I had a question about, in terms of gender equality in fragile contexts, there's an increasing sort of recognition of the role of young people and youth in fragile contexts, particularly, for example, Afghanistan and Iraq, where there's up to half the population is considered youth or young people under the age of 25, for example. And people are specifically looking to that group to break cycles of fragility in those kind of places in various different ways. My concern is that that's a quite an ungendered discussion that's being had around it, and I wanted to see if you agreed. I think I find that quite often people, when they're referring to young people, they're referring to then the more serious issues of economic development, of skills development, of leadership and employment. What they're really talking about is young men. I find it to be an increasingly ungendered discussion, considering that's not talking about the places, the context themselves. We're talking about ourselves, our organisations having that discussion. There's a parallel, along with women, peace and security, there's a parallel agenda of youth, peace and security with its own Security Council resolution that was signed last year and a very interesting process and so forth. But again, I find it to be significantly ungendered, and I'd be interested to see if you agree and why that might be, if there's anything we could do about it.
Right, thank you. I think we'll take the two questions that we have. I don't know if... Oh, where are we? Oh, yes, sorry. Yes, I'm sorry, I promised you.
That's all right. Hi, I'm Clara Strandway. I work on Yemen specifically. Thank you so much for all of your presentations. They've been absolutely fascinating. I've got quite perhaps a broad question, but it's the one that I've been struggling with mostly, perhaps. When you're working in a context, for example, in Yemen, the level 3 crisis, how you can, when we are focusing on getting food and water and the basics. I thought actually you put it so beautifully, when you can't put food on the table, how can you ask someone to step up for their rights, and how can you expect people to be thinking about that? How can we balance the very real direct humanitarian need with the arguably longer term disputed goals for gender equality? How can we, in programming practically, sort of balance those priorities short term and long term?
Right. Well, I'm hearing we had a question that's possibly quite specific and certainly needs to be investigated in the really specific sense on funding. But perhaps somebody might like to just to perhaps respond in a top line general way to that. We've got one on young people and the debates about the fact that they don't tend to be gendered. We don't seem to be able to hold the two identities together. The intersectionality thing eludes us. And then finally, we have the balancing humanitarian need with long-term goals. We're past time. We need to be short. I'm sure lots of you would like to answer one or two of those, but perhaps one person might do one each, and then we'll all be there in the reception. So, Rye, would you like?
Yeah, I think I just want to have a quick, just cover a bit the funding. I mean, the organization that I forgot her name, the lady, Kate has talked about is most of them are based in the diaspora, and this is the Voices of African Women is a WIF project. And there's women from all over Africa based here have been doing fantastic advocacy, bringing people from the ground, but also advocacy at the UK Parliament and trying to really show what is happening on the ground. But quite often, these activists, women's group find themselves with no funding because they are told that you're based in Europe, you don't get funding. So I think there's that dilemma we need to bridge as well. How can we make sure that we use the talent of diaspora people, either from Asia or Africa, who are based here, trying to do fantastic work? How can we make sure that they get the resources they need to influence? Because these people have seen what is happening on the ground, and also they have got something, they have got the tools here that could help them to make their voices heard. How can we make sure they have got platform, but also access to resources? And Mama Khadija is a wonderful example. She has been doing this for the last 20, 30 years. So I think it's really important to bring that on the table as well when you talk about access to funding for women activists, but also those who are living outside their country.
Thank you. I'm sorry we have to be so fast. Can somebody go for one of the other two questions, Diana?
I was actually just going to directly build on that.
Well, be really fast, because we'll
of course
people.
I'm taking the funding question. But I mentioned in my presentation that there are, you know, we see an overall increase in support to gender equality in fragile contexts, but there are variations between sectors. And some things are underfunded, and that includes, I mean, also confirmed in our research, includes women's civil society. So only 1% of donor support to gender equality in fragile contexts is going to women's civil society. And what the limited thing that we can do from where we're sitting and we're trying to do is to just really collect that information and put it out there for all of you, all of us, to try and hold donors to account and try to highlight those gaps to them, and for them to hold each other to account for those gaps as well.
I'm glad I let you said that. That was terribly important. So we should be holding on to that as a key message for tonight, shouldn't we?
And Hannah. Possibly both, but I think on the youth peace and security debate, you know, there are organisations presumably like your own who are ensuring that girls and young women's voices come through in that. But certainly I've done some very, very quick overarching analysis, and many of the documents I have seen have definitely been very ungendered. My understanding is that next year the UN will report and or provide an action plan, and that the Secretary General, the outgoing Secretary General, has promised that will be gendered. You know, the proof is in the pudding, but I think that what is very important is that organisations need to collectively advocate for girls' voices to come through in that, because essentially I think you're absolutely right. Otherwise, youth peace and security essentially means young men with guns, and that is not the purpose, or, you know, that isn't how we have come this far, and that isn't going to take us a great deal further. On the humanitarian need, there's a call to action that the UK kicked off in 2013, and NGOs and UN agencies, governments have signed up to that. I think it's then went to America, now it's with Sweden. But essentially what that says is that on gender-based violence, you don't need evidence to start programming. So you don't need to do an assessment of the levels of gender-based violence to start programming. That programming should start immediately in the way that water and sanitation, shelter, etc. do. And I think that's really important. But actually, that is only one part of a much broader picture in terms of gender and women and girls' rights. And maybe what we need to be looking at is sort of rapid assessments that we do for food security. You know, could we look at adapting some of those tools to do a quick gender analysis that is then built upon?
Great. And Corrie, I think we'll have the final word on that.
Yeah, I mean, just to quickly add to that, I was basically going to say exactly the same thing. So as a food security and livelihoods practitioner, it's really important to us that we make sure that we have a gender angle on what we're doing. And Oxfam has done some really great work in some fragile contexts, such as, I know, Bangladesh, where we've done sort of gendered market programming. So like I was talking about in my presentation, this sort of building this bridge between humanitarian development, where we look at market systems and we identify opportunities for women to enter into those markets and link in the private sector and local financial institutions, and really have kind of a gendered picture of the environment that we're operating in, so that the work that we do, especially around livelihoods and meeting livelihood needs, is not just sort of for the duration of a project, but actually can go for the longer term. We've got some quite good results from that. So yeah, I can give more information on that in the after sort of bit as well.
Right, so we hope we've persuaded you to come and have drinks with us now and keep the conversation going. Thank you so much for being patient with us, not sticking to our 8 o'clock deadline. Thank you so much for being a great audience. And can I invite you to thank the speakers, please?